Let's talk about GABA receptors. We've already talked about biosynthesis and transport of GABA. In fact, we talked about another variety of inotropic GABA receptors previously. Anybody remember the other type of inotropic GABA receptor? No, it's been after a week after spring break, but
aside from C?
No. Besides C's, it's A's, GABA A receptors. Okay? And what kind of current did those gate?
Chloride.
Okay. Inward or outward chloride currents? Inwards. And what did that do to the cell membrane potential? Hyperpolarized it. Okay. Over here, are we looking at a current recording or a voltage recording? Current. Okay. So since this current is going downwards, is that an inward or an outward current? Inward current. Okay. You notice anything about that that looks a little strange?
In
seconds, not in milliseconds. It's a really, really long current. In fact, it's a really, really strong current. It's a very large, intense inward chloride current generated by these GABA C receptors. It's also kind of weird because it's found in these neurons, which if you look at them, you'd never guess what their name was. And it looks sort of like maybe an octopus neuron. Okay. Everybody know what kind of neuron those are? If you read down at the bottom, you do. Horizontal cells. It's even worse because it's really named by the fact that neuroanatomists like to look at them in cadavers. Cadavers traditionally are laying flat on their back. Not really staring because they're not really using the neurons anymore, but their eyes are pointed up at the ceiling. And that's the only condition under which you really should call these horizontal cells, because then they're laying in a horizontal plane parallel to the floor. In your head right now, they should be called vertical cells because they are actually in a plane at a right angle to the floor. But hey, neuroanatomists like to look at dead bodies laying in particular positions, so they have a fetish about how they name things. So we're stuck with that. This is really about the only type of neuron that expresses GABA C receptors. Everyone remember the number of subunits in inotropic GABA receptors? Appears to have given some people some trouble on the last exam, even though we talked about number of subunits an awful lot. That's usually a pretty good hint.
Yeah.
Okay. GABA C receptors are strange beyond those characteristics. They really don't respond to most GABA ligands, with the exception of GABA itself, or we wouldn't even call them GABA receptors. But most drugs that modulate GABA A receptors do nothing to GABA C receptors. So barbiturates and steroids and alcohol and all of those modulators of GABA A receptors, no effect on GABA Cs. We already talked about the fact that it's strange that it's such a large, slow current and quite different from most other receptor-mediated currents, including GABA-A currents. And unlike most currents, it doesn't show any desensitization. As long as you apply GABA, this current stays on for very long periods of time. But the only thing besides responding to GABA and having a chloride channel that's similar to GABA-A's is this last bullet point here. All the known chloride channels that we've found in the nervous system are sensitive to picrotoxin and to its active metabolite, picrotoxinin. But that's about, with the exception of binding GABA, the only pharmacological characteristic that it shares with the GABA A receptors. So if we look at ligands that bind to GABA-C receptors, it is a GABA receptor. The native endogenous agonist for it is GABA. There are a number of known partial agonists. One that's most often used is isoguvacine, but I include the other one on the list because most people, for some reason, seem to be able to remember it. Kaka. We had BABA and GABA. And if you had a fill-in-the-blank question, that seems to be one that people are able to remember for some reason. Probably since you were 2 years old. Competitive antagonists include things, again, the reason we use abbreviations, TPMPA. And we've talked about the non-competitive effects of picrotoxin and its active metabolite, blocking the chloride channel itself. So for one of these rare receptors, we actually know a fair amount about it. Now that's not to say that the other type of GABA receptor we're going to talk about today is not unusual too. They're also somewhat strange compared to other types of metabotropic receptors that we've talked about previously. GABA-B receptors. Does anybody know the general rule of thumb if a receptor has a B in its name or the number 2 in its name? In this case, this is GABA-B, or say for dopamine, dopamine type 2, D2s. Anybody ever heard the term autoreceptor? What does that mean? It has something to do with cars, right? A presynaptic receptor. Even more specific than that, autoreceptor literally means it's a receptor for its own neurotransmitter on the presynaptic terminal. And in most cases, it does something to release of that neurotransmitter from that presynaptic terminal. It regulates its own release. Autoreceptor. And in many cases, it actually reduces the amount of neurotransmitter that gets released after the first release event. Couldn't do it beforehand because there isn't any neurotransmitter to interact with the receptors. But after it's been released and bound to these autoreceptors, then it could affect subsequent events. Okay? Let's look a little bit first at the oddity of its molecular biology. GABA-B receptors come in two flavors, GABA-B1s and GABA-B2s. The first thing that was noticed about these two flavors is that they are always co-expressed in neurons. Anywhere in the nervous system that you find one of them, any neuron, any particular region of a neuron where you find one of them, you also find the other. You never get just one or the other in native expression of these receptors. This was a little bit of a puzzle initially until we figured out the following. You need both types of receptors to dimerize with one another to have a functional GABA-B receptor. Have we seen dimeric forms of metabotropic receptors previously? Okay. Well, this one's even a little stranger than that. If you have an expression system where you get just GABA-B1s, they don't even get expressed in the cell membrane, in the synapse. They're only expressed in the endoplasmic reticulum in that case. They're never transported out to the cell membrane. So it's a non-functional receptor. If you have an expression system where you only have GABA-B2s, They do get expressed in the membrane, but they don't bind GABA, and hence they're not an active receptor. It's only when you get the dimer of both GABA-B1s and GABA-B2s that you end up with a functional receptor. That dimerization, first of all, changes the affinity of the GABA-B2s for binding of GABA, so that now they do bind GABA successfully. And when the GABA-B1s are also expressed along with the GABA-B2s, they then get transported and inserted in the cell membrane and form the dimer, and they're the part of the pair that has a binding site for G proteins. So each of these two isoforms has a different role to play in the function of the dimeric GABA-B receptor complex. Only when you get the two types expressed together and forming a dimer do you have a functional receptor. If you get two GABA-B1s together, it doesn't work. If you get two GABA-B2s together, it doesn't work. Only when you have the pair, what's called an obligate heterodimer, has to be both, is what that term means. Obligate heterodimer. Do you have a functional GABA-B receptor? Again, strange compared to other types of metabotropic receptors. Hopefully you're beginning to learn in pharmacology almost every system has some strangeness about it. Okay. All right, if these are metabotropic receptors and they're mediated by G proteins, any guess on the G proteins involved? If it's for GABA, would you expect this to be an excitatory or an inhibitory receptor? Probably inhibitory. So GI is a good guess. Turns out it's actually GIs or GOs. But again, there's some strangeness about it as we'll go through over the next few slides. The primary effect that was first noted was that mediated by GI alpha subunits. Very little, if any, effect has ever been shown for GO alpha subunits. So what do GIs mediate? What do they do to enzyme activity? They inhibit adenylate cyclase activity. Okay. What did adenylate cyclase use as its substrate? ATP. And what did it produce as its product? Cyclic AMP. So what would this GI activation due to levels of cyclic AMP? Reduce it. It would inhibit cyclic AMP production. If there was much of a GO alpha subunit effect, what would that do to adenylate cyclase activity? It could reduce it, but it could also do something else. It could also potentially activate phospholipase C. There's no evidence for phospholipase C activation. But there is evidence for a role for GOs, and we'll look at that in a moment. That is mostly because of some other effects that are not mediated by alpha subunits, instead mediated by beta-gamma subunits. Which of those subunits are membrane-bound? The beta-gammas. Okay, so they're most likely to interact with proteins in the cell membrane. Not with ones where they can diffuse around the cell. And it turns out those beta-gamma subunits have different effects on different types of ion channels. When we look at the effects on voltage-dependent calcium channels, they inhibit their activity. Are there any presynaptic voltage-dependent calcium channels that are relevant to neurotransmitter release? So that could be a mechanism by which they have an effect on their own release. It's also been found that beta-gamma subunits activated by these receptors have effects on voltage-dependent potassium channels, a class that we haven't even looked at so far because they're not in the normal voltage-dependent class. It would take an extreme amount of depolarization to activate them. Get a neuron up to, say, 200 millivolts or so, above zero. If that happened to your neurons, you would be being electrocuted. Not a normal physiological voltage dependence. But these are also capable of being activated by beta-gamma subunits. And we'll look at all of this in detail in just a few minutes. Let's get the pharmacology out of the way first. These are some of the types of drugs that interact with GABA-B receptors. Which do you think is the endogenous ligand for them? GABA. Okay, that's the one your neurons make and package up in vesicles and release in a calcium-dependent fashion. Most of the others, if you can remember this suffix, lofen, lofen. Think of someone that's not studying. That might help. Drugs with a lofen suffix interact with GABA-B receptors. You need one other clue to make that mnemonic help. One of these is an agonist. Baclofen. So think of someone laying on their back, napping. That would be as contrary to studying as possible. That's an agonist. Completely inhibited in their studying. While the other ones, faclofen and saclofen, are actually antagonists for GABA-B receptors. Baclofen and saclofen. If you don't like it in pictorial form, how about in a chart? Again, GABA is the endogenous agonist. Baclofen is an exogenous agonist. It's actually marketed as an antispasmodic drug. Someone is having muscle spasms mediated by inner neurons and motor neurons in the spine. It can be used as a successful treatment. While faclofen and saclofen and various derivatives of saclofen are competitive antagonists for GABA-B receptors. Okay? And if you remember that lofen suffix, that should help. We've seen other examples of receptors that are affected by divalent cations. And ones that you particularly probably don't want to ingest in your diet, things like mercury and lead, actually inhibit binding of GABA to GABA-B receptors. If you inhibit the binding of GABA to inhibitory receptors, what could be a consequence? Overexcitation, which we typically call seizures. So many of the heavy metals inhibit GABA binding to GABA-B receptors, but not all of them. Manganese and nickel actually enhance GABA-B receptor affinity for GABA. Most of the light metals do as well. Magnesium and calcium in particular are very relevant physiologically. Hopefully you don't go around chewing things that are plated with manganese or nickel very often. I wouldn't suggest putting gun barrels in your mouth, for instance, and licking the nickel off. Don't eat paint chips, just in case they have lead in them. And mercury is another, of course, environmental toxin to watch out for. Now let's look at the autoreceptor effect of GABA B receptors. Okay, it's called an autoreceptor because it affects its own release after the first event. So to measure these effects in this particular experiment, they were actually recording a postsynaptic cell and looking at the GABA A-mediated iPSC, or in this case, iPSP, generated by an inhibitory interneuron. First time you fire the inhibitory interneuron, you get a nice iPSP. Doesn't last very long, goes back away. Second time you fire the inhibitory interneuron, in many cases, you will get a decrement in that iPSP, a reduction in the iPSP. It is not a postsynaptic effect. It's mediated presynaptically by the GABA B receptors that are found on the presynaptic terminal, decreasing the amount of calcium coming into the presynaptic terminal, mediated by GABA B linked beta gamma subunits. Reduced calcium coming in, less neurotransmitter gets released, less neurotransmitter reaches the postsynaptic cell. Somebody's iPhone is ringing. If we apply an antagonist for GABA B receptors, like Faclofen or Saclofen, you can block that presynaptic autoreceptor effect. Has no effect on the GABA A receptors directly, but it allows the normal amount of neurotransmitter to be released because a normal amount of calcium is coming in presynaptically. So the autoreceptor is blocked. If you wash off the GABA B antagonist, you get back that decremental second pulse decrement. Anybody know another term for this phenomenon? Paired pulse depression. Paired pulse depression. The second pulse, the one that's paired with the first one, is smaller. It's depressed because you're actually reducing the amount of neurotransmitter released by a presynaptic mechanism. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. If we look at the actual effect on calcium currents, or in the left-hand case, on calcium spikes, the amount of calcium that comes in during a depolarizing event. Normal event, you apply the GABA B agonist, baclofen, you reduce the amount of calcium coming in. If we look at the whole cell current, applying baclofen reduces the amount of current generated in the cell. And if we look at the IV curves, would you say this is a high voltage activated or a low voltage activated phenomenon? High voltage activated. So we know it's not affecting T-type currents, at least. It's affecting one of the others, maybe L or N's, P, Q, R. Make a long story short, it turns out presynaptically, it's the one that the P-type currents were originally named for. P, they hoped, meant presynaptic. When they learned that it also could mean postsynaptic, that complicated things, but luckily they both started with P. High voltage activated currents, P-type, if you block most of the other high voltage activated currents, you still get the effect of baclofen. because you still have the P-type currents active. If you add an agatoxin to block the P-type currents, then you don't get any additional effect at baclofen. It's a pretty good pharmacological demonstration that it's P-type current. And you can do these kinds of experiments over and over again, and when you block the P-type currents, you lose the effects of baclofen. Okay. Now, how do we know it's due to a beta-gamma subunit? Lots of kinds of experiments you could do to demonstrate that as well. Again, this comes straight out of your Hammond textbook. If you haven't been doing your readings, again, I suggest that that could help when you're looking at things in class. If you look at the total amount of current normalized to what it typically is under control conditions, you keep doing slow pulses and get a standard amount of calcium current coming into the terminal. You apply the GABA-B agonist, baclofen, and you reduce that amount of current in a dose-dependent fashion. Larger dose of baclofen would give a greater reduction in the calcium current. If you do the same experiment but one change, remove GTP from the presynaptic terminal. Is GTP necessary for G-protein-mediated effects?
Yes.
Suddenly you lose the effect of the drug. Has to be mediated by G-protein. Okay, knowing that it's GI or GO, another control you can do is see if pertussis toxin has any effect. Pertussis toxin blocks GI alpha mediated effects. Again, no effect. Also blocks GO alpha mediated effects. Now it gets more sophisticated. Again, we're looking at current and looking at raw data now. Baclofen blocks current dose-dependently. Now we apply monoclonal antibodies for either the beta-gamma subunits of GOs or the beta-gamma subunits of GIs. And only one of the two is effective in blocking the effects of baclofen. Only when we apply a monoclonal antibody that binds to the GO beta gamma subunits and blocks their ability to interact with the calcium channels, do we have any ability to block the effect of baclofen? Removing GI beta gamma subunits from the story doesn't have any effect on the baclofen effect. So it limits it right down to one class of intracellular second messenger systems, the beta gamma subunits that are dissociated off of the GOs, not the GIs. And that's the only case where baclofen has no effect. So those are the kind of experiments we have to do to come up with the simple story of how these drugs work. You have to go through piece by piece by piece, eliminate all the other possibilities till you're left with the one that's correct. Okay. All right, that's the story for calcium channels. We mentioned another type of ion channels that are affected by GABA-B receptors besides calcium. Anybody remember? Calcium channels. These are, again, a weird kind of potassium channels. Not on any of the lists we've looked at so far. These are called GERKs. GERKs. GERK stands for this acronym. G-protein activated inhibitory receptor mediated potassium channels. Again, do you see why we use abbreviations? G-protein activated inhibitory receptor mediated potassium channels. Well, you already knew it was G-protein activated. If it was for GABA, it was inhibitory. It was mediated by a receptor. So the K helps you remember it's a potassium channel. GERKs. All If we do single channel recordings, and again, you can tell that we're looking at current by looking at the scale bar. These are voltage dependent when we get up to really strong levels of depolarization. But under normal conditions, we get a nice outward current. It's an upward deflection in the current. And it's carried by potassium ions. If we look at the whole cell current, we get a slightly different picture. Activate the GABA-B receptors, and we get a nice slow and nice long-lasting outward current. If this is 100 milliseconds, this means this lasts in excess of a second. A really slow, long outward current. If this is an outward current, what would it do to the membrane voltage? Would it look identical to this? Should be about the mirror image of this. Should be a nice, slow, long IPSP, inhibitory postsynaptic potential. So this is an IPSC, an inhibitory postsynaptic current, generated by these GERCs. Turns out that it's hard to see these GERCs under normal conditions. You need one other set of conditions for them to really be active. And that involves activation of other G-protein mediated systems. Because under the normal condition, this obligate heterodimer, the GABA-B receptor, is not phosphorylated. And the GABA-B subunit, the GO beta gamma subunit, does not typically bind to these receptors under those conditions. It's only when these are strongly phosphorylated that you get much binding of the GO G proteins to them. And it's only under those conditions that you get very much then activation of the beta gamma subunits of those GOs. So it requires strong phosphorylation of the GABA-B receptors as well. So that means you've got to have some other kind of receptor activated too. Not GABA-As. GABA-As aren't going to phosphorylate anything. Not GABA-Cs. GABA-Cs aren't going to phosphorylate anything. Any other kind of receptor we've talked about so far that could increase phosphorylation? How about type 1 metabotrophic glutamate receptors? Could they increase phosphorylation? Okay, I know that was before spring break, but it's still stuff on this next exam. Yes, and we'll talk about a number of others as well. So again, this introduces the concept that most neurotransmitter systems interact in your nervous system. It's rare that you have a neuron affected just by one neurotransmitter. They're usually hit with multiple neurotransmitters simultaneously, or at least within a reasonably short time course. So phosphorylation, not mediated by GABA at all, is typically required for activation of these GERCs. Any questions about that?